We get reminded from time to time just how important people are to one another, just any people. Think of the many stories of how solitary confinement damages the sanity of people locked up away from other people. Let's talk about the happier end of the spectrum, people gathering together for strength and health. And in this case, we mean support groups, specifically the ones that help patients and families deal with chronic medical conditions or diseases. Our guests in this segment lead such groups. Gail Gallagher is Southern Oregon Regional Services Coordinator for the ALS Association of Oregon and a return visitor to the studio here at the Jefferson Exchange. Gail, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
Let's also talk to Ted Clay, who is a prostate cancer group support group facilitator. Ted, welcome to you.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. So, Ted, tell us about you in particular. Let's start with you, Ted, because you're new to the exchange. And tell us about how you got involved in this line of work.
Well, having prostate cancer myself in 2001, and I was looking for information and found a group, but it was just about to disband in the Rogue Valley. So I picked up the responsibility for keeping the group going. And so it's been going since 2002, and we meet every month on the first Tuesday of the month in Ashland Hospital, 7 p.m. And if anybody is interested, I'll give you my phone number right now, but I'll give it again later, 482-6435.
6435, 541-482-6435.
Yeah, and we're associated with US2, which is a national association or organization of prostate cancer support groups. So we're actually on the US2 website.
Okay. I'll ask you a little more about US2 in just a moment. I want to get to Gail Gallagher, and let's talk a little bit about you and how you got involved in support group work.
Well, when I joined the ALS Association as the services coordinator about 7 years ago, I was actually very happy to realize that part of my job would be facilitating support groups, because I have done that for years and years, and mostly for hospice before that. And I personally don't have a connection with a family member with ALS. My husband did have a relative with ALS. But in my hospice work, I met a number of amazing people with ALS, and I was always very impressed with the particular challenge that they have and their families have to find their way to good quality of life with a shortened life.
I was going to ask you about that aspect of the hospice work, because it is definitely something that has an end in the near future. And so who are the people who attend the hospice? Are these the families of people who are in hospice?
In hospice?
In the hospice support group, I mean.
Oh, in the hospice support group, there was not so much a focus on ALS, but I did lead bereavement groups for hospice for years. And so the rest of my work was with training hospice volunteers and preparing them to go into the homes to help people.
And so what are some of the benefits of support groups? I mean, obviously there's the whole general social aspect, as mm-hmm. we've just talked about earlier, that people need to be around other people. There's that at a minimum, but what else goes on there?
I think having a diagnosis as devastating as ALS or any cancers, it gives you the sense that you don't know what's in your future or how long a life you have to live. And walking out of a doctor's office, you have a certain amount of information. It's usually pretty scary. You want to know, how do people live with this? Really focus on the living. And that's what I think support groups do best. There is the sharing of how people adapt if they've lost the capacity to do normal things, things we take for granted, like walking, eating, communicating. To be in a room full of people around a table who are demonstrating how they do those things and are still happy with their lives and connected with other people is very uplifting. There's also, there's not a whole lot of tears. There are some, but there's a lot of laughter, too. It's surprising how much humor people find in their situations, and they love to laugh and share how they fell down and who found them and what strange position. I mean, it's not a big laughing matter, but the fact that people have a sense of humor about this very unsettling change in their lives is just part of how human beings cope, and it's part of the camaraderie around a group table.
Ted Clay, I have to believe that getting a diagnosis like prostate cancer, as you got, one of the first things is, oh my God, this is happening to me. Is one of the benefits of support groups that you realize it happened to him and him and him and him and him?
Yes, indeed. There's nothing like seeing other people that are in the same situation as you, or you're struggling with decision-making and here's other people who have gone through that and decided to go with this treatment or that treatment. A lot of the stress around prostate cancer is decision stress because there's no one clear protocol for treating it. Any honest physician who tells you you have a diagnosis of prostate cancer will also tell you there's a multitude of treatment options, and often a patient sort of feels thrown to the wind. You know, it's up to them to decide which option they want to go with, or watchful waiting, or surgery, or radiation, or hormone suppression treatment, and variations within each of those. And so a lot of it is decision stress and getting help and support, knowing that, you know, there are other people who have gone through this and you can talk to them directly and hear their experiences. It's very, it's a great relief to people. There's not a lot of crying and hugging. It's much more of an information sharing, you know, patient-to-patient information sharing forum.
I have to believe if any group is big enough, you're probably going to have people who went through the same decision stresses, and a couple of them chose option A, a couple of them chose B, a couple of them chose C. So the benefit is you're going to have them sitting there saying, oh, that worked great for me, or man, that was just lousy.
Yeah, and if you look at the people that have come to the support group here in Ashland, it's pretty much the same proportions of different treatment options that people go with nationwide. There's a, you know, I would say a large number of people who go with surgery, a smaller number of people who go with radiation. There's people where hormone suppression is appropriate, and there's a few guys who are doing watchful waiting and got the whole gamut.
We're talking about support groups here on the Jefferson Exchange with Ted Clay, who facilitates a prostate cancer support group in Ashland. Gail Gallagher is the Southern Oregon Regional Services Coordinator for the ALS Association of Oregon, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis being ALS. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. And this need not be just about questions for our guests, but also if you have a story about benefits you gained from a support group dealing with a medical condition, please share that with us and let us know what benefits you got, or if there was something that you didn't like about it. Let's hear that as well. 800-838-3760, 541-552-6782, email jx@jeffnet.org. We'll talk about things that pop into your heads. I never even thought about support groups not necessarily helping people. Are there any people you've ever known, Gail Gallagher, were turned off by support groups, just didn't feel like they got anything from them?
Well, I know that there is often a feeling just generally, people will often say, oh, I'm not a group person. Mm-hmm. I don't really want to go to a group.
And a lot of them say that before they go to a support group.
A lot of people do. And we actually encourage people to try coming two or three times before they make up their minds. I've been wanting to say this since I sat down here, and that is that some people, when they're diagnosed with ALS, they wait a long time to tell they're still working before they tell other people. And to have a place where they can come in and talk frankly about, I have this disease and I don't know what I'm going to do about it or live with it, how I will live with it, is of immense value to those people. Some people also don't want to burden their families early on, and so they really keep it to themselves, some people for months and months and months. And this, with a disease in which people may not live more than 2 to 5 years, people need each other. They do need to talk. I would just say that some people stop coming to support groups who actually are living a long time with ALS. They seem to need it less, because they've achieved a plateau and they are living a fairly good quality of life beyond what is normally expected. Those folks tend to drop out after a while. But other people will return who have lost a loved one to ALS. They will come back to be of support to people because they remember what it was like to be there in the beginning of the diagnosis.
To be there for someone else.
Yeah.
Even after their own time exposure to the disease is over with. Is there a particular book on support group meetings, a particular layout for a best way to run a support group meeting, Gail?
Oh, I'm sure there is. And there's probably a lot on the Internet for that purpose.
So what happens at the meetings, basically?
Well, one of the most important things of all, I think, is to have a designated leader who will take responsibility for greeting everyone that comes in and make sure that every single person in that room around the table has a chance to talk and can make connections between people and be able to say, oh, you live in Grants Pass, this person lives in Merlin. People often want to know people that they can get together with outside the group, go to dinner with or have coffee with, and kind of keep each other companions as they go through this journey. So the facilitator, I think, is really important. Also, confidentiality, we definitely stress that. We also don't encourage people to give a lot of advice. We just ask people to talk about your own experience, what's worked for you, or to ask your own questions and not try to solve somebody else's problems. So respect for the individuality of each person.
Ted Clay, you mentioned that when you moved into the prostate cancer support group in Ashland, not only was it on the point of disbanding, but it sounds like you probably had ended up as facilitator in pretty short order. Did it happen that quickly, or am I reading too much into this?
Yeah, I think there was only a couple of months interval between that. It started up at Ashland Hospital in early 2002, and it's kept on going monthly since then. And the facilitator role, I always joke, was my job is to open the door and bring the pomegranate juice. Pomegranate juice has been shown to be an effective nutrient for fighting prostate cancer, as well as some other supplements. But we also just I'm lucky to have a member of the group that really keeps on top of the field and comes in with two or three topics to news that's interesting or amusing in the field. And so we have a combination of going around the group and checking in with people and discussing what is important with the people who've showed up at that meeting, combined with bringing in new information, the latest in, you know, breaking news in the field.
Have you been clear of prostate cancer for a long time now yourself?
Yes, knock on wood.
Mm-hmm. And we will. We will knock on wood.
Thank you.
So, but you're still facilitating this group. I mean, I have to believe there are other people in the group who also have been free of prostate cancer for a while. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, there's there. No matter what treatment you use, if you do choose to get a treatment, there's always a residual chance that prostate cancer will reappear in your life. The probability goes down with each passing year. I think at 5 years, you might be looking at maybe 5 or 10% chance of a recurrence. At 10 years, it's lower than that. I'm at 12, so I like those numbers at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Watchful waiting is a protocol where people watch their they take the standard blood chemistry tests on a regular basis and confer with a physician and have a plan if things look like they're taking a turn for the worse, they get some kind of primary treatment or not.
Ted Clay and Gail Gallagher, again, our guests on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about support groups for people with medical conditions and their families. Our phone number's on the exchange if you'd like to join us, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Well, I think Ted already answered what makes his group meetings different each week. There's usually new information there. So, Gail, how do you make a support group meeting different from week to week?
We actually meet once a month. There are some meetings we have no speaker, no specific topic, and everyone just checks in and talks and kind of confers with each other about how did you deal with this, how did you handle that. Other times we have speakers, and the most popular and most, necessary speakers and topics that we cover have to do with respiratory therapy, speech therapy, physical therapy, and occupational therapy. And we have someone come in and do demonstrations with equipment. And really help people kind of look ahead. So I have ALS. I've had ALS for 2 years, and my voice is much weaker. What will I do if I can no longer speak? And with the speech therapist there, she will bring in examples of equipment, speech-generating devices, and things like that. So we try to be really concrete with examples so that people can see. And also, the people in the room who are using those things, they're always very generous to demonstrate. So we do have a certain number of topics that repeat over every year.
All right, so there is some show and tell. I imagine there's some turnover in the group as well, though,
yes.
In a support group for ALS, mm-hmm. given the prognosis with the disease, which is, did you say, 2 to 5 years is usually the maximum?
Typically, yes, but some people do live much longer. And, I had said that sometimes people drop out if they are living a long life, but we also have people that have lived 10, 11, 12 years who continue to come and are really our heroes. They exemplify how to live a high quality of life in the face of this disease.
Is there a sweet spot in either of your experiences for the number of members that make a support group really work? I mean, any more than that number tends to be a bit too many. Any less tends to be a bit too few. Is there a good number of people to have in a support group from your experience?
For me, any number is great, because mm-hmm. anyone who wants to be there is going to have issues and questions. We've never had more than maybe 15 to 20 people in a group, so it's kind of self-regulating, and that is a fine number of people to have. What about you?
I would say about a dozen.
Mm-hmm.
That's somewhere 8 to 12 to 14 people might show up at a meeting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Makes for a lively discussion.
I imagine so. You mentioned when you were first joining the Ashland Prostate Cancer Support Group, and it was on the verge of disbanding. What was going on there?
There was a person who was coordinating the group, but he was not a cancer patient. He was just, I'm going to do this for a year. He committed to doing it for a year, and when that time was up, he moved on. That's where it lay in 2001.
All right, so things had been turned around and are still going. First Tuesday of the month for your group, as you mentioned. What how big a churn is there in the prostate cancer support group? I mean, obviously there's turnover in the ALS group given the circumstances of the disease itself, but prostate cancer, people can be treated effectively. And so, I mean, is there a fair amount of churn in that group as well?
Yeah, I think that's true. The period of time where a person is most in need of decision support and maybe support in dealing with side effects from surgery or radiation might be a fairly narrow window of time in that person's life. But some people have continued to contribute to the group, bringing their ongoing experience to the group every few meetings, not every meeting, but people show and come back year after year.
Gail Gallagher, this is for you then about the balance in a support group, particularly for one for a disease that does end up fatal, as ALS does. I mean, people certainly would feel better for having gone, but then there's the reality of the situation that is inescapable there. So how is that balance struck at support group meetings?
Well, if I understand your question correctly, there is a great deal of compassion in our group. When someone has been coming to a group for a long time and is noticeably progressing, getting weaker, maybe less able to move, less able to speak, everyone is aware that this person may not be able to come to the group much longer. And this is where I also must say that every ALS patient has around him or her a network or a person who is crucial for the care. And so our hearts are really also with the family caregiver. And sometimes a patient will stop coming, but the family caregiver will continue to come. And we also do have a family, ALS family caregiver support group that meets separately once a month, because those folks have their own issues and also need to be encouraged to take care of themselves. They have quite a large responsibility for taking care of a loved one with ALS.
I'm glad you touched on that, because that actually happens with a number of medical conditions where there are support groups, not just for the patients, but also for the family members, the people who are dealing with that. A friend of mine years ago was in a support group for the spouses of people with Guillain-Barré syndrome, and he said it made a huge difference in his life.
Yes.
People do need that level of support from people who are experiencing what they are, which is not directly with the disease or syndrome.
Yeah, and I really appreciate, too, the number of caregivers who have lost a loved one who will continue to come back and be there with great suggestions and ideas and validation, just being there to say, you know what, you really do need to take care of yourself as well. If you don't have the nourishment and rest that you need, you will not be able to be there as the primary caregiver for your loved one. So those returning people who have lost someone to ALS, whichever support group they come to, they add a tremendous value to our groups.
The medical professionals, doctor's offices, would usually have some information about support groups for almost all diseases, wouldn't they? Just taking a wild guess here about how to contact them. But we're running out of time here. I want to make sure we get Ted's information in again about the Ashland Prostate Group. 541-482-6435. We'll put that up on Facebook. And how about contacting ALS groups?
541-292-8775.
292-8775.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I want to thank Ted Clay and Gail Gallagher for joining us to talk about support groups here on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take a short break and come back with the Writer's Almanac for Friday.